Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 28th. I'm joined this week by culture editor Father Jim Martin. Welcome, Father Jim.
Thanks. Nice to be here in your office.
Well, Father Jim and I are here to talk about the television show Mad Men, which we will be reviewing in the culture pages next week, the week of October 5th, so we're a little bit of ahead of schedule. But we thought we could give a little taste of the piece by Terrence Klein of Fordham University, which is coming up. Before we talk about that piece, Father Jim, maybe you can just, to people who haven't seen the show, we can just talk in brief terms, what's the show about? Why is it worth watching?
Sure. Well, Mad Men is a weekly show on AMC. It runs on Sunday nights at least 10 o'clock Eastern time. It is about the fictional characters in Sterling Cooper Ad Agency in the early 60s. And basically, you know, if you were to look at a précis of the show, you would say it's just about an ad agency. But it's really more about the changing mores, I would say, professional, sexual, social, in the early 1960s. The main character is a fellow named Don Draper, who we learned, I think, in the first or second season, had actually stolen the identity of someone else during the Korean War. So he, you know, there's this whole image of kind of...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert is right, in case you haven't watched the CDs or the DVDs or whatever. He's married to a woman named Betty. They have a kind of happy family, of course, as in most television shows. There's some sadness buried beneath. But I think early on, the show was notable for a lot of, kind of funny flashbacks to the 60s. For example, everyone smoked, everyone drank in the office. One of the things that Terry Klein, who's our reviewer, points out, which really is a great scene, there's a kid putting cellophane over his head from cleaning. Cleaning comes back from the dry cleaners. Rather than, you know, sort of being horrified, as a parent would be today, rightfully so, they say, you know, put that back, you're going to ruin the dress that was under the cellophane. It's a show that people can watch on many levels. One, as kind of a fun sort of flashback, or in this case, kind of terrifying flashback to the 1960s. Two, as a show about what the 60s were like, at least in corporate America. And three, what has changed and what's not changed, really, in the intervening time period. And I also know you're a fan, too, as well, Tim.
Yes, I do like the show, so I am all caught up. And I should say here that we probably will give away some things from the first couple seasons. Maybe this season we'll try to keep generally under wraps
right.
For our listeners. So just that spoiler alert for you. Maybe we can turn to the Terry Klein review, which you mentioned, where he brings in Flannery O'Connor. So what does Flannery O'Connor have to do with Mad Men?
Well, it's an interesting move he makes. He basically says, and this is a fellow who writes a lot about popular culture, has a book out called Vanity Faith, which is very good. Basically, he says that Flannery O'Connor, which is true, in her writing, often sort of, I would say, amplified or turned up the strangeness of some of her characters and some of her plot lines in order to, in essence, get people's attention. That's sort of his point. And in order to show the what she would say would be the workings of grace, God's action in the world, she made the plots particularly outlandish. She made some of the characters a little ridiculous, just so it would get people's attention in this world where O'Connor felt that people weren't paying attention to those things. So rather than being subtle, she was trying to be sort of in your face. Now, Klein says that Mad Men does some of the same things. There's blatant sexism. There's tremendous amounts of drinking. There's great dysfunction in the community. There's racism, homophobia. One of the characters is gay. One of the ad execs at Sterling Cooper is dating a black woman. So he's really turning it up. And, you know, this is not in the background. This is really in the foreground. I mean, this is sort of like the frequently it's the main point of some of these episodes. So his point is that what the creator, Matthew Weiner, is doing is doing that. He's really sort of foregrounding some of these more obvious differences between our time and the 60s in order to have us reflect on them and also to ask questions of, you know, how much of that is really still extant in our culture. Klein says, you know, we might sort of superciliously look back at Mad Men and say, oh, well, we're not racist anymore. And, you know, that's a question. So it's an interesting question, too.
Well, what's interesting, too, is that while he does, you're right, foreground these issues of sexism, homophobia, it's not heavy-handed. I mean,
right.
These issues were there.
Right.
So it's, in some ways, by just being true to the time, mm-hmm. he's bringing them forward.
That's interesting.
We should also, this, as you said, takes place I think it's 1961, 62 we're at right now.
Now it's 63. And 63, in fact, you know, there's some portents of, this is certainly not a spoiler alert, but there's some portents of the Kennedy assassination. One of the characters that you probably know is the name of the boss I always forget. Do you remember the name of the boss with the gray hair?
Oh, I do forget his
name. Yeah. The boss, who you will see when you turn on the television. He's played by John Slattery.
Oh, Roger Sterling.
Roger Sterling. Oh, yeah. Anyway, Roger, his daughter is getting married, and when you saw a close-up of the invitation, I think it was November 23rd.
It was the day after, yeah, right, the assassination. Yeah, so very subtle, but it's there.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of the drama of the show. You know what's coming.
Right.
I mean, the Kennedy assassination is the big thing, but we're also 1963. This is still kind of a 50s culture, right, you know, where women are in their place,
right,
and, you know, men drink and fool around and that sort of thing.
Right.
But you know the time is coming when the feminine mystique and, you know, the women are going to be leaving the home to go into the workplace. So Peggy Olson is one character who's kind of, she's the forerunner.
Yeah, she's terrific. By the way, for our listeners, Tim put women in their place in air quotes.
I did. So I'm sorry.
yeah, Peggy Olson is very interesting. She is, by the way, Catholic. We have to say that. There was in the first or second season, I guess, there was a subplot with her and a priest. They're kind of
really. Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. And anyway, Peggy was hired as a secretary, is very talented and very bright, and has been bumped up to a copywriter. And yet at the same time, she is struggling to win the respect and approval and admiration of not only her male coworkers, the other copy editors, and her bosses, who are all male, but even the secretaries. You know, she comes out of the secretarial pool, and they resent that, in a sense. There's a great scene early on when she moves into her new office and they have to decide, they meaning the secretaries, and particularly this one kind of powerful secretary, has to decide where to put the copy machine, which of course is the size of a battleship. And it goes into her office.
Right.
And it's a big snub.
Passive
basically.
Aggressive, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's interesting seeing how she, I find that very interesting. How does she maintain her sense of self respect and dignity in this world where she's not allowed to be as forthright as you would sort of post Betty Friedan and, you know, post 1968. It's very, she's trying to negotiate that and also trying to be a good person too.
Yeah, I would say the two most interesting characters for me are Don and Peggy. And their scenes together are kind of few and far between, but they're by far my favorite scenes.
I agree.
Show.
That's an interesting comment because both of those characters are so rich and complicated and mysterious too. I mean, we should point out that Peggy had a baby with one of the guys from the office, and it's very complicated. They both have a lot of secrets. And
they know each other, or at least some of them. So, yeah, there is always this tension between them. Not sexual in any way, or it doesn't seem that way, but there is because they know more about each other than maybe they're willing to say or else, or certainly than other people know about them.
The one thing that I find a little odd in the show, having worked in a corporate workplace for 6 years, is that there really are so many of these huge kind of life-changing secrets. You know, someone is not who he says he is. Someone else has a baby out of wedlock.
Sure. But as you said before, they do try to kind of push the envelope a little, foreground these issues. And maybe in doing so, it becomes a little slightly melodramatic.
Yeah, a little soap opera-y. Yeah. But I don't care. It's fascinating.
No, yeah. And it's no different. I mean, Charles Dickens did the same thing.
Right,
I mean, that's
what
literature about in some ways, or great art. Let's get back and talk a little more briefly about Don and Peggy in particular. It's interesting. They're both people of great talent, but also of some sadness. Mm. And that's mixed in a way where, although Peggy, you see her kind of, she's on the ascent. You know, she's smart, she's talented. Whereas Don, it's really hard to get a sense of where he's going because he's got so much going for him. I mean, he's on the surface a very handsome guy. He's got a wife who's beautiful. He's got three children now. And yet, there seems to be this real sadness in his soul, as Terry Klein writes about.
Yeah, and you know, funny enough, and this is not a big spoiler, but last Sunday, one of the characters turned to Don and said, "You have everything."
Yeah,
and you could see this kind of sad look on his face that he knows that, you know, some of his life is kind of empty. He reminds me; he's a pretty existential character.
Yes,
I mean, he's a guy who doesn't, in a sense, he's a person in search of an identity. He doesn't know who he is. He, even in his marriage, which is very strange, I mean, the I find some of the scenes with his wife and his children very odd for his kind of emotional distance. He doesn't know who he is. He does know, however, you know, that he wants to succeed professionally. I think that's one thing that they both have common. And so that when they come into the office together, they're both kind of on this sort of upwards career path.
You mean Peggy and Don?
Peggy and Don, yeah. For both of them, I think it's at a cost for Don, I think it's at the cost of his own identity. He had to sort of subsume this identity. And I think he came from a poor background he was embarrassed about. For Peggy, it's really, I mean, it's her child. I mean, she, you know, sort of has to place with her, where does she place
with
it?
Her sister, I believe. But she sort of disavows it, or at least keeps it at a real emotional distance.
Right. So both of them really do have that kind of inner sadness. I mean, to look at it from a spiritual sense, I mean, there's a sense of, you know, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O God, from Augustine. I mean, there's this very powerful sense of kind of emptiness that you sense within them. And, you know, I think just pushed a little bit, both of them could become this complete career person with, and kind of sacrifice almost their identity. So I think they're both kind of teetering on that right now. Don seems to be moving in more of a direction where he's going to be more of a family man, you know? Peggy seems to be moving away from the family. I mean, literally, she's moving away from her family.
Exactly. She's moving to the city. She's trying new things, drugs, alcohol, sex, all of that. So in some ways, she's trying things that Don has tried to kind of, whether it's to anesthetize himself or whatever. You make a good point about, you know, their kind of hearts are restless, their souls are restless. Is there anybody in the show who you see as kind of a moral center or somebody who is really grounded?
No. I think, you know, as you're asking that question, I was kind of, you know, cycling through some of the characters. I don't think there are too many happy people. There's certainly not that many happy people at Sterling Cooper, which is the ad agency. Right. At home, I think the only person that's probably has her head screwed on straight is the daughter, you know, who's 7 years old. And there's a recent scene where she seems to be the only one that sort of appreciates the gravity of a very sad situation that happened. So no, I think they're all kind of lost. I didn't read that Richard Yates book, Revolutionary Road, or see the movie, but I understand it's that same kind of man in a gray flannel suit. You know, what am I here for? And interestingly, you know, I think what's fascinating for me about the women's side is that this is all what leads to Betty Friedan, right? I mean, it's this sort of nameless dread that she talks about in The Feminine Mystique. And so you get a sense of where that would come from. And, you know, it's also the organization man. William White, I think it is, who talks about that. And, you know, what's the larger goal? So I think it does really portray very well this sense of aimlessness and rootlessness. And that even religion, I mean, Peggy is sort of nominally religious, but that doesn't seem to help her find that much meaning in things.
Sure. Well, why don't we turn to that question? I mean, last year you've been blogging about the show on and off for us. And one of the topics you brought up last year, there was a priest who came to the parish, a Jesuit. A young Colin Hanks, is it, who
Colin
played the
Hanks,
role?
Yeah, Father Gill.
Father Gill, I forgot his name. But perhaps, what was your general impression of him?
Well, it was interesting. He was brought on, I think, as a foil to her. She gives her child away, and I believe the sister confides to the priest in the confessional about this burden of having to care for Peggy's child. Subsequent to that, the priest, breaking all canonical rules, goes up to Peggy herself and, in so many words, intimates that he knows what's happened.
It was ambiguous.
I think
you could read that scene differently.
So depending if, I guess, if you're a priest or a layperson, but I saw him as someone who was sort of using, I would say, not in a terrible way, but kind of in an inappropriate way, the information he knew. In any event, he's kind of there as the sort of voice of authority saying to Peggy, you should take care of your kid and blah, blah. I was worried that it was going to, because this is the early 60s, I was worried it was going to become a romantic duo and that he was going to leave because there were some kind of, significant glances and pregnant pauses when they were together. In a sense, I think she looks at him the way that she looks at a lot of things in her life, for better or worse right now, which is, you know, is this going to be a big obstacle to my career? You know, I mean, so I don't think that her interactions with him changed her that much, it seems. I mean, in other words, you don't see very much residue of it in this season. It's not as if she's sort of newly religious or newly spiritual. There's a funny scene in last Sunday's episode where they're listening to television about the Pope, and
he just died.
John the 23rd would have just died, and they're mad that it's not on TV more, says the mother. And there's no rise from Peggy. There's no sense that this is something that's important to her. So it was a very interesting. It was a three episode arc with Father Gill. I thought it was very interesting. He was portrayed pretty well, I thought.
Well, things said. Yeah. I mean, he was kind of, he was playing the guitar. He was into the new music.
Well, that's why I thought he was. That's why I thought it was, they were setting us up for him to leave.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting. Doesn't he go to her and say, wouldn't you mind copying these things for me, these papers at your office? So he's also a little pushy there.
Yes, he is.
But, you know, hey, you know, not every priest is perfect.
Now, at least in last season, there were a couple other elements. Now, we don't want to push this angle too hard, but that there did seem to be some Catholic themes at work. For example, the one advertising campaign that Peggy was involved in was it for some kind of push pop or something like that? It's Ice Pop, I think it was.
Right. It was something like, and I think the show was called Take It, Break It, Share It.
Yeah.
which, you know, is a very Eucharist. I mean, I think I learned that exact formula. And
it was these Ice Pops that are connected by two. They've got two handles,
popsicle sticks,
and you split them apart.
Right, and that was the ad slogan that they came up with. And, you know, it's nourishment, and there is a lot of Catholic stuff. I don't see it as much in this season, interestingly.
I agree, no.
I wonder if they toyed with that a bit and thought, you know, people are just more interested in the straight plot, the straight drama. I was hoping that she'd be sort of the Catholic avatar almost, but I think that she, in a sense, has kind of left a lot of that behind, as maybe some of the screenwriters have as well.
Yeah, sure, definitely. Peggy is one character who is kind of a woman who has made it to a certain extent.
Right.
You know, she has a good job. But as you suggested before, there are women in the show who are kind of restless
And
do not feel fulfilled. One, I would say, is Don's wife, I mean, who seems very sad.
Very.
And, you know, has three children and, you know, is beautiful, has, you know, a great-looking husband. Yet she still seems, like, incredibly sad.
Well, she's sad. I mean, you could say there's a reason for her being sad, in a sense. I mean, Don takes off at one point and, you know, is a philanderer.
Yeah, that's true.
She then cheats on him briefly. And so I think that sort of contributes to their sadness.
There was this scene in the last episode where we can say it, but
sure.
Where she was in the hospital and she was in kind of a... induced state where she was, you know, confused. She was on drugs, and all she said was, "Where's Don? Where's Don? He's never there when you want him."
Right.
You know, so you got a little of that there.
And a very strange scene. Even my mother commented on it at the very end of the show. Once again, this doesn't give away too much of the plot, but at the very end of the show, she has a baby. Well, that's part of the season, and the baby's crying, and her and Don are lying in bed. And I don't know if you remember, but she goes to the baby's room at night, and the baby's crying, and she just stands there. And there's this sense of...
She's just watching the child cry.
Yeah, do I really want this? You know, what am I doing here? It's a very, you know, I mean, not to sound too highbrow, but it reminds me of Sartre a lot. I mean, people really in search of who they are, almost in a sense creating their identity as she goes along. It is, she does have a sad life. She's very rarely, if you think about it, seen laughing, smiling. Few of the characters are really sort of high-spirited and lighthearted. I can't think of too many. I mean, and in The Office, it's usually at the expense of someone else, or it's because they're drunk, basically.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah, no, she's a very sad figure. And I'm not sure, does she know that Don is actually not who he says he is?
I don't think she does. Mm-hmm. No, they've never revealed that. So that's one thing that... So that's one reason that he's kind of keeping her at a distance.
Right.
But that's one of the tensions in the show, is that you know that here's somebody who's at the age where, you know, in 5 years she could just throw this all, you know, just reject it and say, this is not, you know, who I want to be. Same for the children. I'm often thinking, you know, doing the math in my head, these kids are going to be in Woodstock or, you know.
Well, I keep thinking of, as soon as something happens to the kids, I think there's 5 years of therapy
right
there.
Exactly.
You know, wait till they find out their father's not who he says he is.
Exactly.
You know, the other thing I want to talk about, I don't know if I blogged about this, but I think the title is really interesting to me. I think it works on, for me, three levels. Mad Men, I mean, Madison Avenue, so it's the advertising culture. Mad in the sense that they're, in a sense, crazy a little bit. And I think mad, too, that they're angry. They're angry. Many of them are angry at where they are in life and why they are in life. You get a sense of people feeling sort of really hemmed in. One of the secretaries who's married to a doctor now thought she had this great life, and he ends up...
Is she married to him yet? I wasn't sure.
I think so. She ends up getting raped by him in her office. Mm-hmm. Peggy is angry, you know, about bumping up against walls. I think Betty is angry. So, I mean, Matt, I think the title is frankly brilliant, and I think if you go into it understanding that it's working on these different levels, it actually makes the show a little more richer.
Right, exactly. And I think the title sequence is also excellent because that really gets at, I mean, you have this, it's this kind of animated sequence where you see this silhouette that looks like Don kind of just falling from a skyscraper in New York, but with all the ads going down around him. So there's this juxtaposition of this sadness with, you know, what he's been hired to do, which is to create this world where, you know, everybody's happy and
And also the irony, I was just thinking of it as you were talking, you know, the whole show is about people climbing up, and really what's going on in that sequence is he's falling in a way, and where he ends up in the chair in the animated sequence, and you think, geez, this is the bottom, I guess, for him. It's really, it's very clever, actually.
And one final note, we could talk about this show forever, and I think we should have another conversation.
And Tim and I have, actually.
But also advertising and what how that plays into the show. Obviously, that's what they do. You know, they and this comes at a moment in the history of advertising when it's becoming less explicit and more kind of jokey and around like, the way advertising is today. But they were just on the cusp of that
thing. Right. The famous like VW Beetle commercial. Yeah. And also, you know, they're also I think it is a critique of corporate culture and advertising and marketing because, you know, recently they took on an account of Hi-Li. And because some wealthy kid came in and you know had all this money from a legacy, and interestingly, none of the ad execs thought it was going to fly, but they took it on for the money.
Right.
And so that was the first time I think you really see a sense of, you know, in a sense, unethical behavior that they're taking a guy's money, they're going to promote this thing they know is going to fail, and that's the other joke. I mean, we know it's going to fail as well.
We know these empty Hi-Li stadiums,
exactly
in
right.
Milford, Connecticut.
Exactly, it's a critique, and we could talk about it at some other point, I guess.
I will note though, Don does say to the person, "I don't think you should do this,"
right?
And he's the only person honest enough to do that, so I give him credit for that.
Of all people, the person who's probably the most dishonest person, who doesn't even use his own name, is the most honest in that
right,
sense.
But he was the one. He was in that at least. That section of the show, that episode, kind of was the conscience. Although eventually he said, okay, you know, he goes along with it.
My sense is also, I feel like Don is, this is totally sort of intuiting something, I think. My sense is Don is getting disgusted with The Office. I mean, he's not as engaged. I mean, these days he's just sort of cranking out the ads. And my sense was at that dinner, he was sort of disgusted and said to the guy, that, you know, Hi-Li's not going to work, you know, forget it.
And there's a rift opening up between him and Sterling, who was kind of his buddy, who has now left his wife for a younger woman, which is kind of the path that Don could have taken. And yet he's kind of disgusted with the decision that he has made, you know.
Yeah. And he's gotten more thoughtful, which
is
interesting. And yet, I mean, the other big bombshell I'm waiting for is when Betty and everybody else finds out that he's not who he says he is.
Right, as you mentioned. That could be coming this season. So we're only, I think, five episodes maybe into
it.
So just to place this podcast in time. But Father Jim Martin will be continuing to blog about it, we hope.
Yes.
And we have this piece from Terrence Klein in the October 5th issue, which you should look out for. But we want to thank Father Jim for coming in, and I'm sure you'll be back to discuss Mad Men some more.
I'd be happy to. As long as you invite me, Tim, I'm happy to come back.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Reminder that our culture editor, Jim Martin, who just joined us, has a web-only article up there every week on the website from different authors. This week we have a review of the film 500 Days of Summer by Jake Martin, SJ. And next week we'll have an appreciation of Alex McDermott. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to www.americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy from America Magazine.